May it please the court, Mr. Justice Steele, other justices, already this morning. This is an appeal from a conviction of two counts of unlawful sexual contact in the second degree involving a gentleman by the name of Hector Cabrera. This obviously argument has been heard previously by three justices, and now I have the privilege of hopefully presenting the same arguments to the court as a whole. I suspect that the most interesting issue in this case involves the interplay of the defenses of mistake of fact under 11441 and transferred intent under 11 Delaware Code section 262. And the issue arises in this case from a note that was delivered by the jury during the course of the deliberations on that issue. As I'm sure the court will recall, the facts very simply stated are that the alleged victim here was not related to the defendant. She was staying overnight at his home, went to bed at approximately 1:30 a.m., and alleged that the a person who she was unable to identify initially came into her room on two separate occasions. The first occasion, she claimed he rubbed her vagina. She was under 16 at the time. The second occasion, she claimed that the defendant went even further, actually got into bed with her, locked the door, and proceeded to place his hands on her in a sexual fashion. Again, she was finally able to get up, unlocks the door, runs out of the room, hides in the bathroom for approximately an hour, and then discloses it to the defendant's daughter, well, not necessarily to the defendant's daughter right away, but to her friend.
Mr. Maurer,
yes, sir.
Is it an adjudicated fact that the defendant did not know, that is, actually believed that it was his daughter
and not
the victim?
It's not. I think that was a fact that, depending on how you view the jury's note, which is the context within this issue arises, the defendant testified that he believed that it was his daughter in the bedroom, but he did not testify that he sexually abused the child.
Right.
The jury's note, which may have reflected, as I'm finding out more and more from the trial courts, these notes can be deceptive. The jury's note suggested that at least one or more of the jurors accepted a portion of the defendant's testimony, but not all of his testimony.
Well, that part of it the part that they did accept went to his state of mind or his knowledge.
Correct.
Or his belief.
Correct.
So I gather that we're bound to treat that essentially as an adjudicated fact.
I would certainly take that position. That underlies my arguments that when the jurors came back with that note, they specifically asked the judge for instruction as to what they should do if they found that the defendant was mistaken in his belief that the victim was his daughter.
One last question. You stated, I believe, that the defendant's name was Hector Cabrera. It's Jose, right?
My mistake. Yeah. Correct. I'm thinking of his son.
Mr. Maurer, I think I understand your mistake of fact argument, but what I'm having difficulty understanding is how does the defendant benefit from that when he never presents any facts that are consistent with what I'll call, for lack of a better term, the lesser-included offense or the misdemeanor offense that would have resulted had it been his daughter and not the under 16 guest?
Well,
he never conceded that he sexually assaulted or touched anyone in a sexual way. His theory, as I understood it, was he believed he was going in to kiss his daughter's forehead at night when she went to sleep, and what Jessica testified to just never happened at all.
Correct.
Now, how does he get the benefit of an instruction based on mistake of fact when he presents no facts that are consistent with the benefit he would receive?
Well, respectfully, the jury found that to be a significant issue in the case. Now, the defendant, it's true, did not testify that this happened this way, but the jury, as I mentioned in the other question, believed a portion of his testimony, but not the other portion of his testimony.
All we really know from the note, though, isn't it correct, Mr. Maurer, that someone on the jury wanted that question asked?
Correct.
We don't have any idea.
Correct.
Other than logic tells us why someone might want it asked. That's fairly obvious. But we don't have any idea that there was a single vote for that proposition.
Well, we, again, given the abstruseness of jury notes, that's true. We don't know whether it was 1, 11, 12. But if you look at the wording of the note as reflected in the transcript, I mean, it seems pretty conclusive about where they were going with that. Now, the juries, of course, I don't have to tell this court, the court's well aware that the juries can pick and choose and accept a portion of the testimony and reject other portions of testimony.
Let's focus on your contention regarding the legal error in responding to the note.
Okay.
Can you identify the legal
error? Yes. It's our position that this is not a case of transferred intent at all. If there was evidence in the record that the defendant's daughter was less than 16 years of age, then I would not have taken the appeal. There is no evidence in the record as to the age of the defendant's daughter. There's no evidence in the record, obviously, since this wasn't really an issue that developed, as to what the relationship between the defendant and his daughter was. The jury obviously accepted that there was sexual abuse. So that I think my contention is that if one or more of the jurors believe that the defendant was mistaken as to who the individual was, the jury needed to be instructed properly on how they should make that determination. Transferred intent.
Let's assume they were properly instructed. Are you saying the defendant should have been acquitted?
I am.
So, and tell us again why this is different than a different type of case where you're just wrong about a person's age. You know the person, but you're wrong about their age. And generally speaking, if you think the person's older, but they turn out to be below 16, you're guilty of the crime, notwithstanding the mistake of age.
Well, it's not the age of the person that's an issue. Well, it is indirectly,
right.
But the identity of the person. So.
Let's assume hypothetically the person did touch this child under 16 in an improper way.
Okay.
And you're saying under the way this case was presented, there should be an acquittal.
Under the unusual factual circumstances of this case, that's what I'm saying. What the defendant committed, if the jury believed he was mistaken on that point, based on the evidence that was in the record, was incest, not any other crime, because the daughter very well, for all we know, could have been over 16.
I thought that the issue was he was convicted of a felony because the child was under 16 that the jury ultimately believed he had sexually molested. But if he were laboring under a mistake of fact, he would only have molested under the jury's consideration of the facts. And I say that guardedly, only have molested his daughter who was 16 or older, which would only have been a misdemeanor. How do we get to acquitting him?
Well, there would be no evidence on that point as to whether it was consensual, as to whether this is something that had happened in the past. That's why I say the crime that he was guilty of was incest. Because of the way this case turned with the jury's note, I mean, obviously the prosecution never focused on the relationship.
That's what confuses me. There was no incest because his daughter wasn't in the bed, his daughter wasn't involved. The person who was involved was under 16, and you're saying, notwithstanding that, there was no crime.
I am saying that if the jury accepted that the defendant believed that it was his daughter in the bed, then based on the fact that there was an absence of evidence in the record as to her age, I believe the correct result should be not guilty. Now, Chief Justice Steele, it may be that the correct result would be contact third.
No, I understand your point that if there's no evidence in the record of age at all, I understand now how you get there. How you tee it up factually in this circumstance is what I'm having trouble with.
I'm glad that Chief Justice now understands, but I still don't. If there was unlawful sexual contact of some sort with this person, whoever it turned out to be, if your client thought it was his daughter that he was having this sexual contact with. You're saying that that would not contact, not constitute a crime because there's no evidence that it wasn't consensual?
On this record, correct.
But I thought the evidence was that the victim ran away and locked herself into the bathroom. Doesn't that suggest that it wasn't consensual?
If accepted by the jury after the fact, that's correct.
So there was evidence in the record that this was a non-consensual sexual contact.
There was evidence in the record to support that. I agree with that.
Okay, so doesn't that mean that the only thing that your client could hope to get out of this is the age difference issue that indicates a different level of severity of the crime?
I would say that certainly is one of the results that can be reached. I'm not abandoning the position that the crime for which he should be found guilty, because the daughter never testified as to anything regarding that, should be not guilty. And the other position is that the one you've enunciated.
Okay.
Well, that one is the way I started out, that I thought you were going to the misdemeanor offense for someone over 16. But then the point you made was there was never any proof of the daughter's age one way or another. So absent that element of the offense being proved, not even the misdemeanor was proved.
Well, I think that's my secondary argument. I think the first argument is that
okay, now that I understand
contact
your second
third,
argument, I have to work to understand your first line argument.
Okay, now I'm confused as to which one is.
Before we get to that one, tell us what the court should have done as a matter of law in response to the note.
Okay, and I hope this is the point I want to stress the most. This is not a transferred intent case. It's our position.
I think everybody understands.
Clearly, the instruction was wrong.
Well, wait a minute. I'd like to question you on that.
Okay.
If the transferred intent issue relates to the intent to commit a sexual contact, an unlawful sexual contact, isn't it exactly a transferred intent case?
I would say no. I would say that if you assume for the moment that there was, but let's assume Chief Justice or Justice Sandberger's point, that he believed it was the daughter, that there is some evidence in the record that the daughter did not agree with what he was doing, but there's no evidence in the record that the daughter was under 16. Well, then under that factual circumstances, the defendant's intent was to have unlawful sexual contact in the third degree with a person who was not under 16. So you can't transfer that intent for that illegal act.
I want to set aside the issue of age.
Okay.
Focus on the issue of intent to have unlawful sexual contact. Now, the fact that he believes it's his daughter as opposed to his daughter's friend, transferred intent is relevant for that purpose, isn't it?
I don't concede that, and I respectfully disagree, because
Is it a defense, then, that an absolute defense that he believed it was his daughter?
It was a defense to unlawful sexual contact, second degree.
Well, I'm talking about third. I want to set aside the age issue. The unlawful sexual contact, if he believes it's his daughter, and it actually turns out to be his daughter's friend, isn't transferred intent relevant to show the intent to commit unlawful sexual contact?
On a contact third charge.
Okay. So then the issue becomes about the additional element of the age, right?
Correct.
And there is no defense of mistake of fact for age.
Correct.
So it's sort of, although it's an element of what the state must prove, whatever the defendant thinks about it doesn't matter. Isn't that so?
No, I don't agree with that. If the defendant intends to have, and I don't concede that that's the correct result here, but if the defendant intends to have unlawful sexual contact with somebody who's over the age of 16, okay, and it's a person, okay, it's not like, oh, I thought she was 14. It's somebody where there's no proof that the person is under 16. Then you can't transfer the intent on the felony unlawful sexual contact. The jury was never instructed on a lesser included offense in this case, first of all. And second of all, the jury just went right ahead and instructed, or excuse me, the judge went right ahead and instructed on transfer intent as it applies to the felony level offense.
Your argument assumes, doesn't it, that there must be intent to have contact with someone under the age of 16.
My argument is that whether or not the defendant is committing a criminal act has to do with the person that the defendant selects. And if it's a person who the state hasn't proven is under the age of 16, then that can't be a felony crime, and transferred intent does not apply.
Isn't that what I just said, that there must be an intent to have sexual contact with somebody under the age of 16?
There must be. I don't disagree with that.
All right.
Doesn't the record establish that the victim was, in fact, under the age of
16?
Clearly. Mm-hmm. Mr. Mayor, your whole argument proceeds from the premise that there was a mistake of identity as to who the victim was.
Correct.
But for that argument to work, we have to assume or posit that the jury found that there was a mistake as to the victim's identity. Correct?
I think that it became a jury question. It was not in the first instance. There was no instruction.
Well, we're arguing a legal issue here, right. And the legal issue doesn't become an issue unless it's premised on some fact. And that's the fact that it has to be premised on, isn't that correct?
Correct.
And how is that fact established for purposes of this appeal? Why do we have to accept that as a fact?
I submit that it was an issue of concern for the jury as to what the facts, what the legal consequences of their conclusions on the facts were. Somebody on that jury, one, more, several, was concerned about that particular issue as raised by their note.
But how does that concern of one or maybe more than one juror translate into an adjudicated fact? I mean, my concern is whether this issue of transferred, the issue on which your entire appeal rests, is whether the fact that's the premise for that issue is established sufficiently for purposes of this appeal. Because if it isn't, then there is no basis for your appeal.
Well, respectfully, I think this fact, like all facts, is one that the jury, in reaching their factual conclusions, has to be properly instructed on, if that's where they're going with it. Now, this would never have been an issue if the jury hadn't raised it in their note. One or more of the jurors had concluded that this was an issue in the case.
That may be right. They may have concluded that, but once the juror went back into the jury room, once the jury did that, it's conceivable, is it not, that all 12 of them found that they just didn't believe a word that Mr. Carvera was saying?
Well, we might reach that conclusion. We might also reach the conclusion that the judge's instruction essentially directed a verdict in this case.
I've lost track with all the questions. Did you ever answer my question about
how
the judge
to.
Should have responded to the note? What should the judge have told the jury in response to the note as a matter of law to get it right?
I think as a matter of law, the jury should have been instructed under 11 Delaware Code Section 441 on mistake of fact. And that, I think, would have – now, I admit that the trial counsel did not request such an instruction at that time. In fact, the whole thing went so fast – that there really wasn't a lot of discussion about it. But our position would be that the proper instruction there would not be transferred intent, but mistake of fact.
And how do we get to that in light of the failure to object as a basis for reversal in this appeal?
Well, the defendant did object to the instruction that was given. The court, not to blame the court, really didn't ask for any input from the defense counsel or the prosecutor. The instruction was just given. The defendant did object to that. He did not offer an instruction of his own. He did not articulate what I'm articulating now in hindsight, but the issue wasn't really discussed very thoroughly.
It's easy to look at these circumstances in hindsight when you're not there having to think on your feet, but why shouldn't we simply conclude that defense counsel didn't request an instruction on mistake of fact because the defense that he had presented was inconsistent with it. The defense he had presented was that Cabrera only went in to kiss his daughter's forehead, a goodnight kiss on the forehead. And had he introduced an instruction on mistake of fact that would have suggested to the jury in response to their question that there's a possibility he did go into the bedroom with the intent to have unlawful sexual contact with his daughter, and they might convict him on the original charge, not believing that to be the case. So why don't we just consider this a tactical move on part of defense counsel not to request the instruction that you believe should have been given? And if that's the case, where do we go with this?
Well, if the court reaches that conclusion, you affirm, and we have to go the Rule 61 route.
But it's not an unreasonable tactical decision to say, look, my client just testified. He didn't have unlawful sexual contact with anybody. Now, the jury's question suggests that there's a possibility somebody on the jury believes he intended to have sexual contact with his daughter, whom I know to be over 16, and that, at worst, would be a misdemeanor on these facts. But now what do I do about it? Do I request an instruction that virtually concedes that he's guilty of something when he's testified he's guilty of nothing? Or do I just let it go and hope for the best that there's some jury confusion?
I mean, the record's silent on that. I mean,
but it's not an unreasonable reconstruction of what is going through defense counsel's mind, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. I mean, it's one conclusion you can reach. The problem is, it all happened so fast. I mean, you look at the transcript, and it's like, boom, I object to that instruction. The judge never said, do you have an alternative to give me? He never said, I have an alternative. The judge just went, boom, right ahead and gave the instruction on transfer intent as the prosecutor had requested. And I think that sums up where we are. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Good morning, if it pleases the court. Regarding the first argument, the cases in which there are two general outcomes of a mistake of fact defense. In cases in which the crime charged is divided into degrees by mens rea, the 4 degrees of homicide, mistake of fact defense, I didn't know the gun was loaded, or I checked and it didn't seem to be loaded. I was mistaken when I pulled the trigger. Well, in a proper case, if believed, reduce, say, an intentional assault or an intentional homicide to a reckless one, if the defense is believed. And the other possible outcome is where the mistake of fact defense, again, eliminates the criminal mens rea altogether. If the facts were as I thought they were, what I did was not a crime. In this case, the offenses at issue, unlawful sexual contact in the second degree, of which the defendant was convicted, and third degree, if he intended to commit unlawful sexual contact, but intended to do so to someone who was over the age of 16, again, both those offenses have the same mens rea, intended to commit unlawful sexual contact. The only difference, the only reason there are two different degrees is the identity of the victim, the character of the victim, under 16 or over 16. Neither of these degrees are offensive and have anything to do with the defendant's mens rea, which in both cases is intend to commit some sort of sexual offense and do it. Now, in this case, defendant's testimony was curious in that his mens rea testimony, I didn't intend to do anything wrong, and in fact, I did nothing wrong, had absolutely nothing to do with his mistake. And, oh, by the way, I did nothing wrong to the person I thought was my daughter. So mistake of fact had really nothing to do with his defense, which was I didn't do anything wrong in the first place. I committed no crime. It's not that I was going in a confession and avoidance type of defense. Yes, I admit I was going in there to have a sexual contact with this person, but I thought this person was my 16-year-old daughter and not her 15-year-old girlfriend. So in the case in which it's the identity of the victim or the consequences of the admittedly intended criminal act and simply differs as to the victim, then it seems to me the trial judge's instruction on transferred intent, I intend to commit this crime, but it's just by my mistake, by error, by some reason or another, I did it to the wrong person. No different from taking a shot, say, at someone you know, say age 30, and hitting, by mistake, a pregnant woman or an elderly gentleman, which would aggravate the, say, the assault from second degree to third degree or first degree.
Well, but what Mr. Maurer says, if everything you just argued is true, and it turns out the person is under 16, certain consequences flow. And as I understand the state's position is, if you go in with that intent, and it turns out the person that you have contact with is under 16, that's unfortunate for you because you've created a greater offense or committed a greater offense.
Yes. Yeah, the court, by statute, a mistake as to age is simply no defense. If you have now, if your unlawful sexual contact is with the intended victim and the mistake happens to be that you didn't know the intended victim was under the age of consent, then, well, that's your problem. This case is a little different, but this is more, again, I think the judge's decision to give the transferred intent instruction, I think, is the appropriate one here rather than instruction about mistake as to age, because that's not really what's going on here. It's not that the defendant thought that Jessica, J.H., was his daughter's age or, over the age of 16. It's that he thought, according to him anyhow, this was his daughter or one of his children. But then, of course, also the defendant said he didn't do anything wrong. He just kissed her forehead. And
well, Mr. Donovan, let's switch to the second issue on appeal, if we could. We've seen several cases in recent months where cross-examination has been limited for several reasons. But the focus on this cross-examination was the ability of the victim to perceive the events or relate the events. Given the constitutional dimensions of the right to confront your accuser, what should the rule be on limiting cross-examination? Or stated differently, why was the limitation in this case correct?
Well, I think Superior Court, the judge in this case, and Superior Court in general, in this delicate area, we're going to delve into psychiatric records of witnesses, requires that you make some kind of pretrial notification or motion, at least to put everybody on notice that you're intending to do this. Now, the Black case, which I cited and attached to my brief, Judge Witham goes into all the things that then should go on pre-trial. First of all, make some kind of motion, show your compelling need, identify with specificity what you're looking for. If I find you've made a good showing, then we'll ask the state then to get consent from the witness, and absent that, if the witness refuses, then I'll issue a subpoena and I'll look at the records in camera. Then I'll make some kind of preliminary decision. Either I can turn them over to you pre-trial so your expert can review them. If I decide, well, they may become relevant depending on how the witness testifies, we'll have them here so you can bring your expert in and I can call a recess and your expert can review the records then. Or I may decide they're simply irrelevant pre-trial. And
didn't the alleged victim herself say that she was suffering from a condition at the time that made her drowsy?
Yes, and I think she said actually depression made her drowsy, not so much the medication.
Right. But that condition.
Yeah, the condition,
her,
yes.
Made her drowsy. Was there any application to cross-examine her on that point?
No. No, it was strictly on the medication. She wanted to, and the only side effect she testified to that I can recall is that was weight gain. Actually, the only application was to cross-examine her on the medication she was taking.
Is there anything in the record as to what the medication was?
No, she could not remember. And again, because this was not raised pre-trial, I mean, there were no records whatsoever. The state was caught by surprise. Of course, the court was caught by surprise. Nobody knew anything about it. The only witness with any knowledge was was J.H., and this was several years ago. She was in the Navy now. She had stopped taking any medications. She testified that she had been tried on a number of different medications, and she couldn't remember what any of them were. She was asked about side effects, and she testified only that about weight gain. That's the only thing she could think of. And as far as drowsiness goes, he asked her about drowsiness, and defense counsel asked her about drowsiness, and she just said, well, depression always makes you drowsy.
Did that come out in front of the jury?
No, this was on voir dire.
But as far as her being drowsy?
I don't, whether he asked, well, no, because the trial judge excluded any evidence about a psychological condition. So he could not ask her whether she was undergoing some kind of clinical depression at the time, and therefore that made her drowsy.
He could have asked about drowsiness, right?
Were you drowsy on the night? I mean, she testified that she got tired. The other girls remained in the basement watching the movie. Because she got tired, she went upstairs and she fell asleep. I mean, there was no question that on the night in question she was drowsy. And after she was molested the first time, I think she testified that she fell back asleep again. And then he came in the second time, and that's when she ran out the door and locked herself in the bathroom. So there really wasn't any question that she was falling asleep.
Was it argued to the jury that she had dreamt about this incident?
I don't think so. Pre-trial, there was talk about a sleepwalking defense, but that was on the part of the defendant, but that never materialized. That was the only thing I can think about that had anything to do with sleep in this case.
Mr. Donovan, let's assume for the sake of argument that in limiting the cross-examination on this particular issue, the trial judge committed an error. Would the error be harmless, or would it be reversible?
The error of not permitting cross-examination of Ms. Sue, it would be a Sixth Amendment violation, so it would have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, I take the position there was no violation. I couldn't think of what the Sixth Amendment violation would be in this case. The defendant failed to make an appropriate proffer here. The defendant had no place to go. The defendant had no expert witness on tap. The defendant could go nowhere with this. And simply to throw out the naked fact before the jury that the defendant or the complaining witness, J.H., at some point was suffering from depression when she was a teenager and had been prescribed some sort of medication and was undergoing outpatient counseling at the Meadowood Center would simply, it seems to me, I cannot think why these facts would have any influence on the jury's deliberation whatsoever except under Rule 403 to confuse the issues. I can't see the relevance of that if that's all there was. And once again, there were no records available for examination by any expert witness called by the defense because there was no expert witness on tap. And so this would be simply unbridled speculation leading to confusion of the issues of what relevance, I have no idea. So certainly excludable in this posture under 403, which is why, of course, we have these rather elaborate pretrial proceedings to see if this kind of evidence could possibly be relevant.
Mr. Donovan, is it fair to say that if the jury had heard the evidence about the prescriptions, the evidence would have been that the prescriptions had no effect on her ability to proceed?
Yes. That's what Jessica Sue, J.H., testified to on voir dire. The only side effect was weight gain. And that's the only person there, again, absent some expert standing in the wings, and of which there were none, that's what the jury would have heard. That's it. And they would not have known what the medications were because J.H. could not remember.
So I take it from all that you think it would be harmless error if it was error?
Well, yes. The court is backing me into the error corner. I don't think, again, under the posture of this case, because the defense did not go through at least the minimum of pretrial notification of this possibility to prepare everyone. There was no place to go. I mean, the judge had no option there whatsoever, but to say, no, no, I don't know where you're going. This is simply a fishing expedition. You're just trying to, you know, but throw a red herring in here, which is, I suppose, what confusion of the issues is under 403.
Well, can't someone be cross-examined generally? Were you under the influence of alcohol or drugs or any other mind-altering substance at the time of your observations of this event? Isn't that a general question that can be asked on cross-examination?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think there has to be some proffer. Once again, it's that throwing out this negative in front of the jury with nothing to back it up. No, I think there must be some sort of proffer that you can, in fact, produce a witness in rebuttal, or you have some kind of indication that, in fact, the defendant was intoxicated or drugged at the time. Otherwise, you're just throwing out these suggestions in front of the jury. I know when the state does it, it gets slammed, and I suppose the occasionally with a defense witness, and certainly what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
How about eyesight? Do you have to get pretrial clearance to ask someone about their vision?
I think you have to make some kind of proffer. You should make some kind of proffer. I don't think it's appropriate to just...
In the absence of meaningful discovery in a criminal case, how would you know that there's a basis to ask the question in the first place? So you could make a proffer, as you suggest.
You would have to know that ahead of time in some other way. I mean, here defense obviously knew that J.H. in this case had suffered from depression. I mean, they had that information, presumably from the defense, from the defendant.
Well, I thought after the voir dire, they knew she was taking medicine, but she couldn't remember the name. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what she testified.
So why wouldn't it have been proper to say on cross-examination, were you taking medicine? Did it have any effect on you? And have her say, yes, I was taking medicine, I can't remember the name. Whatever it was, its only effect was weight gain.
Well, I simply do not see the relevance of that to anything in the case. I mean, we have said you are taking medicine. Everybody takes medicine for one reason or another. She testified that, there was no one there to testify that it has any effect on her that would be of any relevance to the
case.
Why
do we ask defendants routinely when they enter a guilty plea if they have recently consumed any drugs, alcohol, or medicine?
Because the defendant has to be clear-eyed to make this very important decision to give up important constitutional rights. Now, a witness on the stand isn't doing that. A witness is simply trying to recall as best as possible, and one is not asking them if they're under the influence now, if the witness is slurring speech or weaving back and forth. Certainly there's some indication
But doesn't that simply show the operative time that this is relevant is when the actions at issue happen? And in this case, the question was, on this night, had you taken drugs, alcohol, or any medicine? Why wouldn't that routinely be a proper inquiry?
Well, it's not a routine question to ask the witnesses. Unless there's some reason to think that on a particular occasion a witness was under the influence of, say, an hallucinogen or something that interfered with one's perceptions. And here there's absolutely no reason to do this. Again, the judge went the extra mile here and allowed voir dire, didn't just cut this off, said, okay, I'll let you question the witness here outside the presence of the jury and see if there is anything to what you're saying, and it turned out to be nothing. There was nothing to put before
the jury.
Was the
judge's ultimate ruling relevance? Why was it excluded?
Irrelevance, and I think both a combination of 402 and 403. The judge couldn't see the relevance, and if it had some marginal relevance, it was certainly outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to this witness, and also as I said before, the danger of confusion of the issues, just throwing this naked fact out there before the jury without any context whatsoever.
That's an interesting concept. Where does the principle of unfair prejudice to the witness come into play? The witness isn't on trial.
No,
what's that got to do with anything?
The danger of unfair prejudice to a party. Now, if it's to the witness, then it would be to the party also, the party here at the state. But this would be intimidation, basically, of witnesses. It's difficult enough to get witnesses to come in and testify in prosecutions. And if they know their medical records are going to be dragged out every time they walk in.
Well, that's why we have subpoenas, correct?
Well, yes, it's nice to get the witnesses as our citizens coming in voluntarily and welcoming the chance to take part in this wonderful.
Well, the state has the option of the subpoena before trial, the Attorney General subpoena. Defense counsel doesn't have an option of bringing a witness into their office to ask them questions. It would help them prepare a proffer about their medications before they testify, correct?
Correct, and that's why Judge Witham and Judge Pooch and the other Superior Court judges have written about proper procedures to do this. If you think there is a reason to go into this, please raise it pretrial. And
well, that's why I asked my earlier question. If we assume the jury assesses witness credibility and we have a constitutional right of confrontation by the defendant, what you seem to be saying is, it's true the jury assesses credibility, and you can test the witness's credibility through confrontation. But in the absence of pretrial notice that you want to delve into this type of area, you forego your constitutional right to do that.
Yes, because you fail to establish relevance. In this case, that's the problem. The defendant simply wanted to engage in a fishing expedition here, had some indication of this particular witness had suffered from depression at some point in the past, and from there wanted to know what medication she was taking. Yes, there are procedures to establish relevance, but that should be done pre-trial. Again, there are important considerations about the privacy rights of witnesses.
In terms of your comment about fishing expeditions, it may not be the best trial practice to ask questions that could be characterized as fishing expeditions, but isn't that, in a sense, what a cross-examination by a defendant's counsel is about, is to try and ask enough questions to pull out something that can raise questions about this witness's story or this witness's credibility, either one. So isn't it appropriate to allow defense counsel to ask about what has now been established to be a fact that was operative at the time of the incident, even though there doesn't appear to be anything that would demonstrate that that problem had any impact? You get to ask the question, you get to probe a little bit. The witness says, no, the medication had nothing to do with anything and all that. Because maybe the witness will admit that, it did make me a little foggy sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, you as defense counsel have something to argue. And if it doesn't work out that way, then that's the end of what you can make of what you hoped would be a point in your favor. Isn't that kind of the way it's done, as opposed to what you seem to be suggesting, which is unless you get medical experts lined up and so on and so forth, you can't ask questions about a person's mental condition at the time of the incident?
Well, I suppose 2 points. First of all, the judge did allow that kind of cross-examination, but outside the presence of the jury, and then it was discovered through that cross-examination the witness, who was the only witness, had absolutely nothing to add. And second, the reason why we have the pre-trial procedures is if this had been done pre-trial, there could be medical records on hand, if the judge thought it was relevant, having reviewed the medical records in camera ahead of time, And if the defendant had an appropriate expert witness to explain what the medical records are about, this may very well have become relevant. The problem is none of this was done. There was no preparation done ahead of time. And just coming out as it was, you're stuck with what J.H. says. And what J.H. says is nothing, basically.
Okay, but shouldn't the jury have heard what she had to say, even if it didn't really go anywhere, because it was a condition she was suffering from at the time of the incident, and it's worth inquiring into in front of the jury?
I disagree, Your Honor, because it's irrelevant at this point. It's irrelevant, and under 402, and the trial judge has the obligation, or at least the discretion, to exclude irrelevant evidence. Had Jessica J.H. said something marginally relevant, like, as Your Honor said, oh, yes, it may be foggy at some times, or sometimes I imagine things that weren't there, or, one side effect is hallucinations or something like that. Well, yes. All right, at that point, certainly. But J.H. said nothing, and weight gain has absolutely nothing to do with this case. It was unfortunate that she gained weight. I can't imagine it helped her depression at all, but it really doesn't have anything to do with her ability to perceive what happened to her on that night. So I see I'm about out of time.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, you have a little over 3 minutes. Perhaps you can talk about the second issue for a minute,
I'd hope the court would address this a little bit. The interesting proposition here, if I can try to do it as concisely as possible, is whether or not the defense prosecution needs an expert witness to question a witness about things like cocaine usage, drug usage, prescription medication usage, alcohol usage. I disagree with Mr. O'Donovan. It's routine in the trial courts of the state, for those of you who sat on, you know this, to ask witnesses whether they've been drinking, whether they took any drugs, whether they're under any kind of prescription medication, without utilizing an expert witness or having one waiting in the wings to testify to the effects.
Is it fair to suggest that jurors probably have in their lives some personal experience with people who are under the influence of alcohol, certainly, and perhaps drugs on some occasions, but very few jurors have any expertise in the extent to which prescription medication affects a particular person in a particular way without some help from an expert?
Well, of course, I think that's I don't know. For somebody who's sitting on the jury who doesn't drink, how do they know? I mean, they only know what they read in the newspaper or what they've seen. With prescription medication, I would urge that similar analyses should take place, and that it's fairly widespread in our society now. If you take something like Wellbutrin, or if you take Xanax or Ativan or something that can affect your ability to perceive or recall.
Well, why did the trial judge handle it badly if what the trial judge did was allow it to be explored on voir dire so the trial judge at the conclusion could make a determination about whether, to the extent it had any probative value, that probative value is outweighed by the danger of speculation or misleading the jury or confusing the jury about the real issue? Why was handling it on voir dire, learning what would have been offered had the jury heard it, and then doing the 403 balancing wrong?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the record supports that balancing was actually done, number one. Number two, I think there's also two issues here, and I only have a minute. Mr. Donovan's correct about the issue regarding the pretrial applications for mental health history, and there are reasons for that which are legitimate reasons. This particular case, I know Justice Berger was just questioning Mr. Donovan, I would rely on those kinds of questions for the proposition that was something that the jury should have heard. And furthermore, for those of you, all of whom probably have been trial lawyers, you don't necessarily question a witness in front of the jury the same way you do on voir dire. So it may be the trial counsel here could have approached the examination on the utilization of prescription medication in a different fashion than was done in the voir dire examination. The point is the jury was unable to consider that factor and were precluded from hearing that at the time that the events occurred that this person was on prescription medication that could have had some impact on her ability to perceive, recall, recollect, even if she said no 3 years later. So anyway,
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.